Joining me this evening on the phone is Dwight Hunter of the vocal group The Hunters Four. How are you tonight, Dwight?
Just great.
Well, let's start right at the beginning, if we can. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Caldwell, Idaho, and raised on the border of Oregon and Idaho on the Snake River Valley on a farm. Born in 1941, raised there until I was about 13, and we moved to the big city.
To the big city. So what would that be?
That was over to Corvallis, Oregon, where Oregon State is, and to us that was the big city after being raised in eastern Oregon.
What was it that got you interested in music?
My family is very musical. There are 8 of us children, and my dad and mother absolutely loved music. I didn't like it so much in the beginning. I was about 3 years old, and various combinations of family members that were constrained into singing from time to time, and at 3 years old I was pushed into the limelight and had to sing, and I didn't like it that much until I discovered that I could sing parts, that I could harmonize, and then I got such attention from my parents and family that I said, well, this is pretty good stuff, and sang then from then on, and we enjoyed music around the table while we were waiting for dinner. We'd break into harmony, sing a song on the way to church, back and forth. We were always singing songs and trying to reach the best harmony we could obtain.
What music groups or individuals started to influence you, say, in junior high or high school in that area?
Well, that was a pretty exciting time in just the evolution of rock and roll. There were up-tempo music. I'm thinking of Black Slacks and things like that. There were some Peggy Lee and Patti Page and Doris Day and all the different kinds of pop music, but that's when suddenly it was Elvis Presley, Pat Boone, the Coasters, all those different groups. It was an exciting time when music suddenly drifted down into the junior set, and everybody was entranced with this exciting new music.
Let's get right to the group then. How did you get the group together?
Well, I had sung from the time I was little, and I discovered the guitar when I was about 8 or 9, I guess, and took it up seriously. So sang in public quite a bit just as a single, emulating Elvis Presley in blue suede shoes and Don't Be Cool and all of those things. Being in high school, you looked around for a drummer and you looked for doo-wop singers and found people who could sing. And we started out as the Silvertones and sang at a lot of dances and assemblies. In those days, the schools sent entertainment assemblies around on a circuit, and one school would send their program over to another school and then reciprocate the other way. And I was always in those shows, either as a single or as a group. When we discovered that Silvertones was the signature label of Sears and Roebuck musical instruments, we thought we better find a new name. Brothers Four were fairly popular at that time, and since I had formed the group, somebody thought of the idea of Hunters Four, and mimicry being the form of flattery by that name stuck.
Who were the members of the Hunters Four?
Well, the members were Rob O'Connor. This is later. We had earlier members. We had a drummer who couldn't keep a beat. I won't mention his name.
How nice of you.
And then Rob O'Connor, who played bass and also could play guitar. And then we had two, the Marquis sisters, M-A-R-Q-U-I-S. That was Jen and Betty. And being sisters, they had a close, understated harmony that was very tight. And then I sang lead, and they sang the harmony and the doo-wop parts.
So did you have a lot of local shows as the Hunters Four then?
Yeah, a lot of them and a lot of dances. And for a vocal group, playing dances for 3-4 hours is quite a challenge. But in those days, you could make a lot of money playing for programs. The Daughters of the American Revolution or the Rainbow Girls or all these different groups, the Lions, the Elks, and so forth, would have dinners, and they would want some entertainment. And you would be able to go in and sing 2 or 3 songs and get paid quite a bit of money. I remember I would go in and I would sing. I'd see a lot of gray-haired folks, which unfortunately I am now. And I'd say, okay, I think they'll like Harbor Lights. I think they'll want Autumn Leaves. And I would sing those, and a little voice would come out of the back room, do you know any Elvis? I said, oh, yeah, I know that. So then I'd sing Elvis, and they wanted the more upbeat rocker tunes than the ones that I anticipated they would want.
So you're outperforming, apparently, as a solo and as the Hunters 4 and such. But before you made the record, I guess I would really be interested to know how that came about. I mean, where were you at the time that you were discovered, shall we say, and how did that process work?
Well, that was intriguing. I was working up in Tacoma, Washington, as a civilian, helping frame houses for the Air Force around McCord Air Force Base. And I was just trying to make some money for college to attend Oregon State in the fall. And in those days, any chicken coop or barn, any facility of any size, no matter how humble, there was often on the weekend a band and a dance going on. And it would be country western, sometimes more rock oriented. And I happened to run into somebody who said, let's go out to this barn or chicken coop. I can't remember where it was. And Buck Owens was playing there. And this was long before he was famous. I remember his steel guitar man was Dusty Rhodes. And we were introduced to him. He had us sing a little bit. And he said, from now on, when we take intermission, when we take a break, the Hunters 4 can come in and sing a few songs. And so we did that for quite a few weeks. I worked in Tacoma, then the other band members would drive 3 to 4 hours up, and we'd sing at intermission, and were quite thrilled to do it. Buck Owens indicated that he would like to record us, but he said he didn't have any resources at that time. This was long before Tiger by the Tail or Hee-Haw or any of that.
And what year was this now?
This would be the summer of 1959. So he said that he had already backed up a group, and you'll remember them, Skip and Flip, and had spent some of his resources in that direction. It hadn't panned out. It seems to me they had one hit record called Cherry Pie, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Cherry Pie, and they had a song called It Was I.
Okay, well, the Cherry Pie, and we sang that one and really liked it. It has a cute harmony to it. So somehow we got introduced to another Owens. This wasn't Buck, and no relation to him, and certainly not country western. He owned a music store. It's kind of like The Wonders, that movie. It was called The Record Bar in Tacoma. And he came to us with a contract and with a management opportunity and offered to record us. And of course, as young kids, we were thrilled to do that. He also took us to music picnics where the Wailers were playing, the Fleetwood, other groups at that point in time in that area of the Northwest.
So tell me what you remember about the experience of going into a professional studio, which I'm going to make an assumption you may not have seen until that time, and what was that like?
Well, that is intriguing because this shows your age, but in the early days, I would try to record, if you can believe it, on steel recording devices that had the steel wire.
Oh, like a wire recorder.
Wire recorders. And they were extremely primitive. And hearing yourself on those, you'd give up music altogether. And no one in those days could afford a tape recorder. And the only folks who had one would be a church or a school. And so you'd borrow some of that equipment and try to experiment with recording. Few people, when they hear themselves the first time in a recording, believe that that's really them, because the sound inside their heads is different from what's emitted outwardly. And so when you first hear your first recording, very often you get very humble. This was a recording studio, the John Bowles Studio, and it was a partnership owned by Art Mineo of Sal Mineo's relative and John Bowles in Seattle. He had all of these legends up on the wall, the Pat Suzuki and other mostly jazz-oriented outfits, but he'd also done some of the other rock and rollers in that time. Why it was so different is because it was so meticulous with so many takes and mixes and so forth. And just for two songs, we recorded most of the day. And by the end of the day, we were extremely tired, and some of the cuts that got on are the period when we were very tired and soft-spoken. Yeah. The flip side, who could ask for anything more, is very fast and up-tempo, and I have to sing this really high falsetto. And by the end of that last recording, I was hyperventilating practically, just sucking oxygen, just trying to keep up. So it was so much different. And then in addition, they were able to dub over some studio musicians, a little extra guitar, a little drum beat that really helped out a lot.
So based on your description there, it sounds like they went to quite a bit of expense to book a whole day of recording time and to follow up with the overdubs.
Yes.
So they were very serious about getting you on a vinyl.
Yes, they were. One of the ironies, one of the funny things was that the record label was to be the bar label because the record bar was going to come out with his own label. So he called it the record bar. When it went to the printer, somebody screwed up and put an E on the end, so the label says Bear Label, which caused a little humor in certain quarters when it came out.
Okay, so now you've been to the studio, you've recorded the song, you've got a vinyl 45 that's out there. What was your plan?
My plan was pretty humble because I wasn't very much of an aggressive out front guy. I'm number 6 out of 8 kids, and so you kind of had to wait in line a little bit. And I just loved the music, and we did a little bit of minimal touring, a lot of not bandstands and not Philadelphia bandstands, but bandstands in the Seattle area. Lip-syncing and radio interviews and playing the record. And our plans were to do more, obviously, and be able to do an album and more singing. We got a contract, and I had an appointment with Conrad Hilton in Hollywood to pursue maybe Nicky Hilton was getting ready to maybe do a recording effort of his own. And I was supposed to go down and meet with them and talk about contract possibilities. I did go down there, but about the same time I had another thing pulling on me, and that was the opportunity of becoming a missionary for the LDS Church. My brother was in Norway, and he wrote some fascinating letters of experiences he was having, and I kind of was being pulled that way, and it was time when I should be. I was enrolled in engineering at Oregon State. I did go down to Hollywood. I didn't keep the appointment. The longer I was there, the less interested I was in pursuing music at that point and going some other directions. I had understood that the label was subsequently sold to Columbia. At least that's what I was told by our manager. I believe you told me that it might have been picked up on the Josie label, which is something I knew nothing about, never heard about.
Yeah, actually, according to my research, the Josie label did issue that in, looks like, early 1960.
I'll be darned. I did go ahead subsequently and went on a mission to Georgia, Florida, Puerto Rico, and Alabama, and came back, and I had had a football scholarship prior to that. I had played 1 year at Oregon State, and I was going to play at Brigham Young University, where I had a scholarship. And I came back and said, you know, all that is really great stuff, and I'd like to pursue it, but I better get an education and get started on my life. And so I kind of diminished those things at that point in time. I determined that I could stay active in music all the rest of my life, which I've done. I've always kept guitars, Stratocasters, and Telecasters cracked in my living room with an amp and microphones and all the fake books, and still to this day, sing with members of my family and anybody else who wants to, and remember many of those old songs that are still so important today.
There's an interesting story that you mentioned in one of the emails to me, and it had to do a little bit with payola.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to have you just go ahead and tell that story.
Well, talk about the naivety, I guess, of youth and those times. We're doing a series of radio and TV interviews. They'd be playing our record, and then they would interview my manager and I, Hal Owens. And we were sitting in KGW in Portland. Red Robison was the DJ, and he was very prominent, very important on the West Coast at that time. We were up fairly high on the charts, I think at 8th position, and he was playing our song and interviewing us, and we were responding. Then he cut to a commercial, and my manager says, I don't understand. Last week we were at this level, number 13 or 8 or something, and this week we're not even on the chart. What happened? Did people quit requesting it? And he said, for $2,500, you can be number 5 next week.
Wow.
And we just sucked in our breath. The realization was stunning. And we said, we'll have to think about that, because it's certainly against my nature to do something like that. I knew nothing about anybody else experiencing that. And it was about 3 weeks later, the whole Payola scandal erupted. Red Robinson got fired along with many other disc jockeys. And I don't know that the practice desisted, but it was certainly an eye-opener to me. And it was things like that that kind of soured me a little bit from the music business. Also, the girls in our group were naive and sweet young ladies, fine young ladies. And there's a certain amount of lechery around some of these stations with people. They'd break and they'd want to dance with the girls. And at one point, one of the studio guys said, where are you going to stay tonight? Why don't you boys go stay at the Y? And he says to the girls, I've got two great places for you at my house. And the girls said, well, that's really nice of you. That's great. And I would tell the girls, no, that's not nice of him, and I'm not going to let you do that. So it was that kind of stuff that you love the music, but sometimes some of the business and monkey business parts of it would kind of sour it for you a little bit.
To your knowledge, then, besides the station that you mentioned, were there some other local stations that were also jumping on the record?
Yeah, we obviously the one in Corvallis, our hometown, and then KMO in Tacoma was the major one, because that's where we started. And the other ones that were running, we had Chris Lane at KJR in Seattle, and KNew in Spokane, KXL in Portland. That was a fellow named Dick Drury. Ray Brim in King, Seattle. Art LeBoy at Radio K-Pop. Earl McDaniel at the same station. Bill Balance at KFWB LA. Bob Salter at KVI in Seattle. And Steve Brown at KISN Kissin in Vancouver, Washington, across the river from Portland, and then, of course, KGW.
So you really had quite a few stations up and down the West Coast that put it on their playlist.
Yes.
Did you ever get any kind of figures on how many copies you sold?
Never did. We knew that they had a limited number of pressings in the beginning, and then they allegedly had sold it to Columbia and were going to release it. I knew nothing about Josie, so in terms of money, that I have contracts, but I didn't. I never inquired on. I knew it wasn't a bestseller, and there probably wasn't much money generated. And the terms of the contract were something like 3 cents. I'm reading the contract right now. 3 cents per copy for every regular piano forte copy, 10% of the retail selling price, and that was pretty good in those days.
Mm-hmm.
50% of all net sums received by the publisher from mechanical rights, blah, blah, blah. And so that was the contract. I knew that it wasn't a bestseller, and so there probably wasn't any revenue generated much.
Now, you were the writer on at least one of the sides, weren't you?
On both, yeah.
Dwight, do you keep contact with any of the other group members? Do you know where they are?
Yes. This is kind of a funny story. We just had our, I think, 45th high school reunion a year or so ago up in Corvallis, and found out that all the members were going to be there except one. And he was about 50 miles away, and that was Rob O'Connor. And he had evolved into agoraphobic individual and didn't go out much. They couldn't get him out much. And yet somebody dreamed up, wouldn't it be great if we could reprise the Hunters Four and sing again? So I've kept active all these years, so that wasn't a problem. I got the two Marcus girls to come, and they had not listened to the record since clear back then. And I thought that was tragic that they hadn't. They said they told their kids and grandkids that they had been talented and done some of these things, but they figured it was old tales because they had no evidence. So the three of us practiced and got ready for a surprise program at the reunion. And I called the fourth, trying to tease him out of his hermit cave so he would come down. And I said, Rob, I haven't seen you forever. And if you just came down and just sat in the audience, we'd go ahead and sing. And if you felt like you wanted to sing, you could come on up, and it would be so great. If you don't feel like you want to, that's fine, too. We'd just love to see you again. So surprisingly, he came. I asked him, if you come, why don't you stick your guitar in the car? And he came, and about 10 minutes before we were to do this surprise, he came up and mumbled, "Can we go tune up?"
Huh.
And I said, "Great." So we sneaked out the back door and tuned him all up, and we sang our songs and then sang four or five of the others that were popular at that time, and really had a good time.
What a great story.
So I then came back and converted the record to digital and made a CD, the shape, and had the record on the CD. I took the graphics and pasted it on the CD electronically. I'm a computer head in real life. And sent that, and then this thing that I'd sent to you, the email, with some of the background so that their kids and grandkids would know that it really was true.
It really did happen.
Yes.
Well, Dwight, is there anything that I may have missed that you'd like to talk about with concerns to the music that you made?
I think only, and maybe this is a sign of my age, but, and that would be that the music was so exciting in those days because there were so many innovations occurring. You had Les Paul and Mary Ford and the echo effect. All the electric guitars were emerging and experimenting. All of the groups, the black groups especially, were emerging with exciting new sounds. I heard Jackie Wilson, and I couldn't believe a man could have that kind of a voice and that talent. And so it's every couple weeks new records came out, and you just thrilled to it and had to get it as soon as you can. Or could. I went down to the music store, and I would get in the booth and play them and memorize them, then go home and write down the chords and the words, and then I could sing them because I couldn't afford to buy all the music. And I think we've lost certainly a lot of that now. There's a period of time in the decade since where the music is hard to sing to. It may not even have a beat, but it's not memorable. It doesn't stick in your mind. I get the big, thick fake books with music from the 50s, 40s, on up to the 90s and 2000s, but I still go back to those songs that were so rich and so enjoyable to sing.
Dwight, thank you very much for taking the time out to do the interview, and I find all the stories that you've shared very, very interesting.
Well, thank you so much, and what a nice thing for you. I'm just moving along in my life and remembering the good old days, and so this has been a lot of fun for me.